I would like to continue the program proposing to this space an embodied exercise with everyone. And it's more of a self-exploration with your own body. And I would like to mention that there is no right or wrong. We are not looking for perfection. So it's really a moment to reconnect with our own body. And maybe we're going to be also doing the exercise, me and Jules, and maybe we hope that everyone can maybe watch one of us and follow. And it's a very simple exercise. We want to connect with our underbelly resonance, and for it, we just have to locate it in the body. And we will start by placing the index fingers together and making a sort of a triangle shape. We will place it exactly on the head resonance point, which is the nose bone. And we will slowly even imagine that this vertex prolongs itself through the frontal. And we will slowly inhale and exhale through the nose. In and out at your own rhythm. Just take a moment and enjoy. And from here, we will use half of this triangle and invert it. And we will place half of this triangle connecting the thumb in the belly button. And the index finger is now actually in the region of the underbelly. And we continue inhaling and exhaling. Inhaling, connecting to the head resonance. And exhaling, connecting to the underbelly resonance. In and out, still at your own rhythm. Now, if we imagine this region of the underbelly expanding towards the lower back, we can use our imagination and just imagine that a mouth opens in this lower back region. And while exhaling, we could use connection with our resonance, and we could hum. So inhaling through the nose and humming while exhaling, or imagining this resonance. Let it fill in the space. Mm-hmm.
monster! Moment!
Monster has been a cue for my own work for a long time. I'm going to get back to the monstrous body in a bit, but I want to stay with the sound and meaning and this connection that we just might have felt. Something not happening, not working, technology. Okay, I'm going to continue. What I will do is, some of you might have received a handout. I'm going to tell you the number of quotes that I'm going to be reading, and you can read with me on the piece of paper. If you don't have one, just listen carefully. I try to read slowly. I think maybe we will have to wait for this to work before I continue. In the meantime, I tell you what we are going to do, at least sketch what we are trying to do, which is to combine our different practices of working. Angelo's practice comes from classical singing and art practice, and my practice is an academic practice. And we've been engaging for months in a dialogue between our different practices. And we've both been working on the same topics, namely on the question of how to produce embodied knowledge. And we both realized that we've been frustrated by the different types of practices that we've both been engaging in. So this is an experiment that is continuous, and this presentation today is part of this continuous process of trying to disrupt the different types of practices we've been engaging in. I think this, is it working? Okay, cool. All right, let's get back to the listening, to the humming, to the making sound with our bodies. I'm gonna be reading quote number 9 on the handout. It's a quote by Jean-Luc Nancy in his book, Listening. To be listening is always to be on the edge of meaning, or in an edgy meaning of extremity. And as if the sound were precisely nothing else than this edge, this fringe, this margin, at least the sound that is musically listened to, that is gathered and scrutinized for itself, not, however, as an acoustic phenomenon, but as a resonant meaning. A meaning whose sense is supposed to be found in resonance, and only in resonance.
Are we critical explorers?
Yes, I hope so. But what can be the shared space of meaning and sound? That's the question. Meaning consists in a reference. In fact, it is made of a totality of referrals from a sign to a thing, from a state of things to a quality, from a subject to another subject, or to itself, all simultaneously. Sound is also made of referrals. It spreads in space, where it resounds while still resounding in me, as we say. To sound is to vibrate in itself or by itself. It is not only for the sonorous body to emit a sound, but it is also to stretch out, to carry itself and be resolved in vibrations that both return to itself and place it outside itself. End of quote. The relation of sound to meaning is what we struggle with when we want to communicate the connections between resonant bodies and minds. How do we verbalize this relation? How do we put in words the resonance between the sounding body and the world in which this body is being read, mainly through visual categorization? Which vocabulary or which alphabet do we have for voicing the resonating connection between the sounds we hear, feel, or make, and the thoughts we form through language? To locate meaning in sound might open up ways of attending to the invisible resonances through which bodies can communicate.
Ich muss sprechen, um zu wissen, was ich denke.
That's very true for me as well. But also, I feel like for many, many years, I had to write in order to know what I think. And I think that's where I have a problem now. Because I realized that the transition from experience to writing is not a very successful one. It's not stable, and it's not just to my experience. So I'm going to read quote number 3 from the handout. It's a quote by Susan Kozel on process phenomenologies. I examine closely the transition from raw experience into scholarly writing. Phenomenological theories are not born whole and complete. They are rather uncooked and messy at first. When I refer to phenomenology, I mean a reflective process that is subjective, embodied, and situated, but also exploratory and critical. I confront the accusation that academic writing deadens, dampens, or diminishes experience into the accepted discourses of academic research. Dancing, bleeding, weaving, and writing are all embodied processes.
So
the consideration of resonance provides a clear dynamic of relationality. The relation between voice, sound, and meaning, between bodies. If we think of experience as enveloping us, then dissolving into something else, our writing about it, is a play between arriving, making sense of it, and it transforming. End of quote.
It informs, destabilizes, confuses questions, agitates, exposes, challenges, disorders.
That's why it's important to incorporate the process in writing, because of the effect of destabilization. So for me, the premise of a critical theory-making tradition called process philosophy is that we must develop a theoretical practice that counters the static and the fixing descriptions of our lived experience. This philosophy contends that form and content of any theory is itself transformed by the dynamic relationships of bodies, lives, and experiences it engages with. What comes to the fore here is that the theory not only consists of what it is about, but also always consists of its own production processes that are temporally, spatially, culturally, and bodily specific. Especially theory engaging with bodies and embodied experience must therefore reflect the chaotic and sometimes messy bodily states of the theorist in processes of writing.
A wild horse! Proper prose is motion life, humanless.
Proper has always been the goal in my writing, but I'm gonna try to give it up. Thanks to you. What then, I ask myself, can a theory look like that does not cancel out, but rather deepens and enriches the embodied processes from experience to text? I want to think that theory would profit from treating text not as the final product of thought, but as a temporary and unfinished score for engaging in dialogue with others. Dialogues are necessarily open-ended, prone to misunderstandings, allowing for failure, committing to conflict, and engaging in communicative resonances beyond language. With underbelly resonances, I hope to venture into a dialogue that opens up to the fragile and invisible, yet resonating vibrations of embodied thinking that should become part of the process of all theory making.
It agitates the embodied performer of the thought. Erotique.
That is a cue to my experiences of pregnancy. For which I am going to read quote number one on the handout by Maggie Nelson. Is there something inherently queer about pregnancy itself, insofar as it profoundly alters one's normal state and occasions a radical intimacy with and radical alienation from one's own body? How can an experience so profoundly strange and wild and transformative also symbolize or enact the ultimate conformity? Or is this just another disqualification of anything tied too closely to the female animal from the privileged term, in this case, non-conformity or radicality? End of quote. In my experiences of pregnancy, queerness played a huge role. I went through a constant transformation of my body that I experienced as intimately pleasurable, as well as reflective of my genderqueer identification. This experience was also reflected by how my body was read, especially in late pregnancy, where I was perceived as either subverting gender by being read as a man while lugging an 8-month-old fetus around.
Adaptable. Malleable.
Or, strangely, I was read as subverting my own queerness by embracing and enjoying the alienation from my general aversion against family planning conformity.
Not homo. Not homo.
Genius!
The experience of passing as either strictly heteronormative woman, pregnancy does that work for you. Or fleetingly as a man with gestating belly, contradicted in so many ways how I actually felt during my pregnancy, that I wonder which tools I would have needed to transpose my embodied experience into a text, into a script, a language, or a theory that could be read as, look, here is a body that feels transitional, erratic, sexy, doubled, strange, and monstrously beyond your categories. Do you read me? I wonder, on the basis of this experience, which I still carry with me as a sort of treasured memory, what a vocabulary of transitional embodiment would sound like. how a social reading of such a body might resonate with my body politics, and how other transitional forms of embodiment could be more kindly translated into language. An embodied theory would here ideally serve as a sort of crutch or handrail for developing an embodied vocabulary or an embodied literacy. I want to talk about literacy for a little bit. I'm going to read quote 7 on the handout by Carolyn Marvin. Literacy, we conceive to be a set of variable and culturally specific techniques for organizing, expressing, and performing social relationships around the interaction of texts and bodies. A mark of literate competence is skill in disguising or erasing the contribution of one's own body to the process of textual production and practice. A mark of literate power is the freedom to command other bodies for textual display or concealment, as the occasion warrants. Literate acts aim at dissociating mind from body. To practice literacy is, at the very least, to disguise and repudiate the body. At most, it is to damage or destroy it physically, morally, and emotionally. If literacy is not exclusively a mental skill, any conceptual shift to the notion of literacy as an embodied practice has important consequences. End of quote.
Disguise, eliminate, repudiate, correct. Disguise, repudiate, eliminate, correct. Disguise, eliminate.
The disguising that's going on in the writing process about bodies is what led me to think about writing as the practice for knowledge production and how it could be queered, subverted, changed, made more visible in how it works. So I want to understand literacy as a way of perception rather than just a form of cognition that is being used to write. Literacy as a practice incorporating voice, tone, feeling, gesture, movement, smell, taste, desire, or touch. Such literate practice is prone to the risk of failure. It will not work without exposure to other bodies, minds, and sensations, and it will necessarily be practiced differently by different bodies. So what are we gonna do with the alphabetic body? The alphabetic body that we could call the body of literacy is that body which is being produced by literacy. I wonder what other sorts of body we could produce by what we could think of corporeal literacy or corpo literacy.
Possible versions of not yet.
So corporeal literacy is a term that I want to use for the work that we are both doing, Angela and I. I'm going to read the quote by Michael Blaker, number 8 on the handout. Corporeal literacy is a perspective that brings out the performative character of processes of perception and cognition, focusing particularly on the corporeal dimension of literate practices. More than describing the capacity to read and write, corporeal literacy denotes culturally specific synesthetic modes of information processing through brought about by culturally specific practices of noting down, storing, and transmitting information. These practices, therefore, beyond simply providing useful tools, profoundly influence how we think, and understand.
Sokash.
The singing of Angelo does something to my process of thinking, which is that it disrupts my concentration. I have never really figured out how that works, but it must have to do something with some kind of buried embodied experience of earlier in my life. Anyway, that's what we wanted in this process, to disrupt each other's practices. And so, as critical as Angelo is about his singing practices, they're very useful for disrupting my own. Anyway, I'm going to try to continue in my line of thought. Corporeal literacy might be a tool to provide us with a new alphabet for embodied knowledge production. It blends two concepts into one and transforms both elements. Corporeality and written language. The two concepts seep into each other, decompose and recompose, destabilize yet support each other. Corporeal literacy is a theoretical concept, as well as the name for a practice of doing literacy otherwise. It names a research practice that incorporates and questions my literate skills in exchange with, and sometimes in conflict with other skills of communication. In my theory-making practice, I want to train corporeal literacy as an active form of perceptual cognition that takes into account its own means of embodied production, and that makes space for the material conditions of those theoretical concepts that I have been writing about for so long in theory. Like vulnerability, care, queerness, disability, failure, conflict, desire, and disorder. However, as much as I find corporeal literacy a useful term, I do not want to understand it as an ordering principle to ever be flawlessly performed, but rather as a gesture, a communicative capacity or a temporary vocabulary that gives us tools for experimentation through which bodies can express themselves and be read more fluidly.
Oral.
There's a theory tradition that I neglected a lot, and I want to train myself to learn it, which is called theory in the flesh. I'm going to read a quote, quote number 6 on the handout. Chicana feminist writers Jerry Moraga and Gloria Anzaldúa rebelled against existing paradigms that required the dissociation of their lived experiences in order to claim the label of intellectual, public, or otherwise. Instead, they transgressed boundaries of genre, of method, of content, of disciplines. They claimed fragmentation and hybridity, not as a methodological development or an intellectual intervention, but as best representing their lived experience. Theory, they claimed, should not come from written text only, but from the collective experience of the oppressed, especially that of women of color. Theory should emanate from what we live, breathe, and experience in our everyday lives, and it is only in breaking boundaries, crossing borders, claiming fragmentation and hybridity, that theory will finally be useful for liberation.
Nessun rispettatore di barriere.
To let the other speak requires the invention of multiple methods. That's a broad racist, heterosexist, and imperializing language. That was nice. So, wrapping up.
Excuse the outburst.
I'm just checking the time. So we're supposed to wrap up. I think what I just said about the theory in the flesh relates nicely to our last planned embodied exercise, which I connect with several things, perception and cognition, support and letting go, but also with a sort of urgency. It's like the urgency to react and to speak about what is there in the moment. Okay, I'm going to give over to you for the instructions.
So I thought of bringing another embodied exercise. And I had to think that our practices simultaneously becoming and displayed here and now as we try to engage them, engage also corporal literacy in the moment, and they dissolve the boundaries of process and result by connecting dialogical flows of perception and cognition, as you said before, materialized through the performativity of the voice. And this is like an embodied process that requires from us moments of in between of letting go. And I think that in my embodied experience of singing and embodied practices, letting go is the most difficult thing I've encountered, actually. And I think I would like to bring an exercise here that might give you some insight of actually how do you deal with it bodily, and analyze it for yourself, actually, experience it by yourself. We will demonstrate it maybe first together, and then we open up for everyone. And I acknowledge that there's different kinds of bodies in the room. So I think after we would like to reach out to everyone and as much as we can, and support you also in doing. So it's an exercise that destabilizes the vertical position, which I really like. And I wonder, how can we make it visible for everyone? So it engages interdependency between bodies and letting go by the generosity of giving. And we usually, let's do diagonal, it's always great. I don't know. So, so we come, tell me.
We can move, they can move.
Exactly, we can move, you can move. So if you cannot see us, be free to move. So we come together, feet in relation to the shoulders. We do it into phases. The first, we just lean while giving, and we inhale from the nose a little bit, and we give away our weight. Yeah, exactly. And we come together by sighing. Once more. So, we inhale together, staying with our core and giving, and come together. Exactly. And the next step is leaning and squatting at your own angle. We do it. Inhaling, squatting. Yeah, yeah. So, failure is acceptable.
Happens
and we deal with it. So, and that's, it's also when you get the more information from. So I was talking about giving while letting go, and what happens, and I hope you feel it also if you do it afterwards with us, that if you hold on, you destabilize our relation. So we do it again. Yeah. And come together. Great. Would people like to take the space? It's also an exercise that can be done sitting, so I would be very happy to come to you, and we can do it sitting as well. But, and I would love if people will try a different relation than the number two, but maybe in three people. And don't be shy. I will totally do it with someone that would like to do it with me. Someone? And you will do it with someone else as well.
I just want to warn you. This is work. Can I just have for a second? Okay. It might look easy, but it's actually very, very hard for me. So that is one thing that we didn't talk about, but did talk about a lot in our dialogue, is that discrepancy between how something looks and how the invisible, monstrous embodiment or disabled or queer embodiment has a very specific relationship to the visible, as we also heard with Olave's talk. Okay.
Yeah. You can totally do it together, and I will just support you in doing so. So basically you come together and feet in relation to the shoulders. Very good. And you inhale a little bit from the nose. And then we do just the first part of leaning and giving away the weight. Yeah. And coming together with a sigh. And now we will do it a bit wilder. What about that? So inhaling from the nose and giving, 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 giving away. Yes. And exhaling. Could we try squatting? So inhaling and squatting at the same time as giving. Squatting a little bit. Yes. And it's destabilizing a little bit. Good. And coming together. So the trick is not hold, but give. Queer generosity. Maybe a bit closer so that you can have the... Exactly. Great. Inhale. And squat. And come together. Yeah. And spend the time you want with it. And if you want to teach other people, I would really much appreciate it. How is this going?
It's great.
Do not hold. Give, 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 give. Stay with your core, but give. And come together. Wow. Thank you. Thank you. Your best assistant ever. Yeah. I never did it with four, but we can. Oh my God. So we just lean first, maybe?
Sure.
Inhaling and giving. Yeah. So do not hold, just give away, and then coming together, we can do it better. Better. So do not hold. You stay with your core, but you just give everything you have to us. Yeah? Here we go. Yeah. And coming together. Great. You do the next phase with squatting.
Sure.
And I try to help someone else. Thank you. I look at you. So not holding, give, 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 everything, yeah. So you can relax also the pelvis. Yeah, with you I can touch, not ever. And then coming together.
I only breathe out.
So we do it again.
Yeah. Yes, squatting one.
So, inhaling and giving. And coming together. And you can give, you can lean more on her.
Okay.
Like totally. Trust. It works. So inhaling and squatting? Yeah, or leaning. It's, sorry, I destabilized this relationship. Yes. Yes. Give, give, give. Great. And let go. Another day. Just believe. Another day. Just breathe.
Okay, so there's 10-minute break now. No?
We
have 10 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Oh, right. We're actually done.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.